So I suppose I describe my theological anthropology, as it were, probably coming from a kind of a reformed background. I've been very influenced by Van Til, Schaeffer, and others. That's where I'm coming from. So you know, there's not going to be any surprises there in what you're hearing, probably the Dutch reformed missiology. And in my exegesis of, the exegesis of Romans 1, imagine a cosmic game of hide and seek, where the stories we've been told is that God is hiding and we've been looking for him, and we've looked for him everywhere and we can't find him. Now, we know from Romans 1, as I'm not going to read the passage out, I imagine you spend a lot of time looking at it, that's not the problem. In the cosmic game of hide and seek, God is not hiding. He has revealed himself. He's made himself manifest. People know. There is a kind of God has made himself known. He's not hiding. One little exegetical point is what is Paul talking about where he talks about the invisible qualities of God, his eternal power and divine nature have been revealed so that humans are without excuse. I once spent a whole day when I was teaching in a seminary, looking at every commentary on Romans and how exegetes try to understand what eternal power and divine nature means. And people are basically struggling. I mean, there's some ideas, but what actually, I mean, Paul could have used other terms. What does eternal power and divine nature mean here? And here I think J.H. Babbink's very helpful. And I'm labouring this point because the magnetic points we're going to talk about are really the outworking, that this is the clay out of which he builds this theological, anthropological framework. So he says eternal power is this idea that we know at some level that we are creatures and we are dependent upon the eternal power of God. There is a creator-creature distinction, but there's this, it's the idea of dependence. We know that we are dependent creatures. Now, after the fall, that dependence doesn't go away, but it's substituted for other things. But before, we knew, Adam and Eve knew that they were dependent upon God. That's what it means that God has revealed his eternal power. It's the idea that we know that fundamentally we are creatures who are dependent upon something, someone else. And divine nature, well, here Babbink focuses not so much on the divine bit, but on the nature. That is, God has a nature. God is not a something or an it, but a someone. And with that comes accountability. So dependence and accountability, Babbink says, are kind of hardwired into all human beings. And whatever the fall does, however much we suppress the truth, substitute it for idols, we never get away from the dependence and accountability to something or someone, be it God or an idol. Now, we'll come back to that because the magnetic points are kind of built out from there. As you'll know in Romans 1, God is not hiding. We are hiding. We suppress the truth. It's interesting, with Tim Keller having gone to glory in the last few days and some of his influences. J.H. Babbink is very interested in, at that time in the 40s and 50s, the burgeoning discipline of psychology. So sometimes his language has quite a psychological, psychoanalytic kind of flavour. So when he's interpreting what does suppression mean, katakontone, literally holding someone's head over the water, underwater, he's very happy to say this is it's a repression. There's an idea of repression here. I think Freudian. Well, yes, but he doesn't. It's interesting. His doctorate was on the reform mystic Heinrich von Suso. So there's a very mystical kind of way that he writes. And again, this is why he loved ministering in Indonesia. So we suppress the truth and we substitute it for other things, as is a classical way. And in that sense, he's very, coming from Calvin, you know, we are the fabrica idolorium, we are a factory of idols. And then I suppose a model for this messiness of people who are running to God and running away from him, who know him and don't know him at the same time. His exegesis and others of something like Acts 17, a city submerged in idolatry, You know, it's interesting. Stott's commentary makes the point that that's the only time a city is described as submerged in idolatry. But Paul's approach here, again, this would be some other apologetic asides that I can't go through here. Interesting, when people talk about Acts 17, Paul starts, he is talking about Jesus and the resurrection. They say, you're a babbler, the seed picker. And then so he has to do what I think is a run-up and a run through the big worldview picture, and you know there's lots of discussions on that. But the word that I want to focus on is when Paul calls the Athenians religious. I've read what basically PhD theses on what this word might mean, Deus Daimonsteros. And I think the context is key. It can't simply be, hey, isn't it great you have this unknown God, and I'm just going to now, this unknown God is Jesus, because Paul's has a paroxysm because he's seen idolatry and he calls people to repentance. Whatever is going on in the middle are bookended by those two, that, you know, provocation to idolatry and the call to repentance. But I do think it is more than a simple saying, you know, there is a contact here. Interestingly, some other commentators have picked up on this. Greg Barnson's one in his, I think, very helpful book, apologetics book, Always Ready, linking it again back to the Romans 1 passage. It's not beyond possibility Paul cleverly chose this term, Deus Daimonsteros, precisely for the sake of its ambiguity. His readers would wonder whether the good or the bad sense was being stressed by Paul, and Paul would be striking a double blow. People cannot eradicate a religious impulse within themselves, as the Athenians demonstrate, and yet this good impulse has been degraded by rebellion against the living and true God, as the Athenians also demonstrate. Although people do not acknowledge it, they are aware of their, here we go, relation and accountability, Romans 1, to the living and true God who created them, but rather than come to terms with him and his wrath against their sin, they pervert the truth. In this they become ignorant and foolish. One of the things I want to explore is actually that idea of dependence and accountability is, I think, maybe why Paul chooses the particular quotations from Erastus and Epimedes, which I think, in him we live and move and have our being, dependence, we are his offspring, accountability. So I think there might be some contextual, kind of intratextual links between Romans 1 there, what's going on in Acts 17, and the particular reason Paul chooses, which I think for me, again, these are huge issues that I'm sure you've discussed before. I think those are, Paul quotes those as evidences of what suppressed truth looks like. He's not simply taking atomized statements. They have to be understood in the, what you're believing ignorance, I'm now going to proclaim to you. Okay. Now that's all by way of base theological anthropology. That's where I'm coming from. And again, you know, one way to critique it is to say, oh, that was great stuff, but the foundations were a bit dodgy. And that's fine. Let's have that discussion. Now, the magnetic points then, this is where I want to come to, is that Bavinck's a deep scholar of religion. He knows his Bible. He's a good theologian. He's in Indonesia, in Jakarta, and he's looking at all the different world religions. I hate that term, but I'm going to use it for shorthand. I do away with all of it, but let's go for world religions as we understand it. And he says, look, they're saying very different things, but there seem to be some commonalities in the same issues that all human beings seem to ask. There seem to be similar questions that people struggle with. And he calls these magnetic points. He says, it appears that humanity always and everywhere has fallen back on definite ideas and presumptions, and that these ideas and presumptions always resurface in surprising ways whenever they have been temporarily repressed for various reasons. This is what he calls a universal religious consciousness that remains indestructible in the midst of all disturbing and confusing developments. So what in Bavinck's theological anthropology, the suppression of truth and the substitution for idols, but that the fact that we know God and don't know him, we don't lose our image of godness. If you put all that in a blender and mix it around, what comes out is what Bavinck calls religious consciousness. So it's not simply, hey, this is a great thing. This is the suppressed truth of idolatry. But it does give us something to look at, which he calls religious consciousness. And then how do we describe religious consciousness? How do we unpack it? Well, Bavinck says that there are these magnetic points or direction signals, or in my terms, there are these particular itches that all human beings have to scratch. Now, what my work's been trying to do is to say, in Bavinck's books, in his book on religious consciousness, which interestingly, as an aside, this is how great Bavinck was at the time. He did a book called Religious Consciousness, and Mircea Eliade, the world-famous religious studies Romanian scholar, on the basis of that book, invited Bavinck over to teach in Chicago, and the lectures there became this book that Bavinck wrote called The Church Between Temple and Mosque, which we has just come out with a new introduction that I've written, by Westminster Seminary Press. And that was, so he was teaching, like Eliade called him over to say, come and teach on religion and religious consciousness. So Bavinck says there are these five magnetic points. And my work is saying, translating that from what you might call a world religions context to your post-Christian, secular, again, using all these terms, I know they're heavily freighted with meaning, post-Christian, secular, meta-modern, if you want to use that term increasingly, or whatever, however you want to describe it, the situation we're in at the moment in the West. Bavinck has some intimations in his work about how that might happen, but really I've tried to make the contextualization or the translation. So these magnetic points are not to be compartmentalized. They're all perspectives on the one religious consciousness. But of course, people might enter into the religious consciousness from different views. So what I try to do now, we're going to try and replicate this, is to just very quickly go through the magnetic points. And I want you to start thinking, in your context, in your cultures, in your local communities, with people that you know, so try and get as specific as possible, how are these people manifesting the magnetic points in their lives? Now, Bavinck says, and again, it's not as if people are waking up thinking, oh, I believe in a magnetic point. But people's lives are a response to these magnetic points, which are the suppressed truth, the substituted truth, dependence and accountability of which they come out. So these aren't Bavinck's titles, these are mine. So there's five. We'll do some in groups, we'll do some together. And just I'll get you a feel for how this framework works. And then what we'll do is we'll see how Jesus subverts and fulfills them. So totality, is there a way to connect, is the question that human beings ask. And Bavinck says, you know, we all have this innate sense of totality, that we know that at one level that we're small cogs in a much bigger machine, that we are interconnected. And with this, Bavinck says there's this tension between feeling insignificant as humans, who am I? I'm just an existential speck in the universe. And, or when we connect with something bigger, we suddenly find our identity and we feel that we are significant. And so we crave belonging to something bigger, some cause, someone. People enjoy communal awareness. He says people crave connection, feel abandoned after they've experienced it, and crave for it again and again. Now, in the book, what I try to do is show how popular culture or any kind of culture or the Western culture tries to answer that magnetic point. So, I'll give you one practical example in the book. Now, I know, and I don't know, there's various people in this room, but I know that young people don't use Facebook anymore, but you know, the old people do. So in 2011, Facebook had its 1 billionth user in 2011. Right, listen to this is the ad campaign for Facebook. Chairs. Chairs are made so that people can sit down and take a break. Anyone can sit on a chair, and if the chair is large enough, they can sit down together and tell jokes or make up stories or just listen. Chairs are for people, and that is why chairs are like Facebook. Doorbells, airplanes, bridges. These are things people use to get together so they can open up and connect about ideas and music and other things that people share. Dance floors, basketball, a great nation. A great nation is something people build so they can have a place where they belong. The universe, it is vast and dark, and it makes us wonder if we are alone. So maybe the reason we make all of these things is to remind us that we are not. Now, I'm not a betting man. I don't think Mark Zuckerberg has read J.H. Bavinck. He may have done. But you see that idea of totality. And again, lots of different examples. Why in the UK especially is there an interest in family trees, genealogy? People want to feel as if they're rooted to something else. Why when I go on the London Tube is it all about dating agencies? Match.com, silver singles, her. Because people want, they want to find that one, in the Jerry Maguire sense, who will complete them. So these are examples of totality, belonging. How do I connect? So that's totality. You get the idea. Right, norm. Is there a way to live? Bavinck says, we all know that there are vague rules that need to be obeyed. There are moral standards to which we adhere. There's an appreciation of transcendent norms, and this brings up with it a responsibility to live up to those norms. Now, this isn't Romans 2, well, it's kind of a perversion of Romans 2 in terms of the works of the law written on the heart. This is any kind of culture has their own norms. And again, it's working out what those norms are. So, in the book, a friend of mine that was in a shop. A lady pushes a buggy in, pushchair into the shop and says to the owner, are your straws paper or plastic? The owner says, paper, and she says, thank goodness I can drink here now. So for her, the norm was, if you don't have a paper straw, I'm going to be out of your shop. Yeah. So the norms are working out. And of course, the problem is we all have different norms. Why was there the controversy over Will Smith slapping Chris Rock? Because no one could agree what the norms were there. Is he standing up for his wife? What a great norm. Is he? This is just kind of abusive and violence, a different norm. So these are clashing norms that we have. And again, all people are living by these unwritten commandments, I suppose, that need to be recognized. Even subcultures that try to go against the general norm have their own norms. So in the book, I talk about an ex-student of mine who in their youth was a gothic. And goths have their own rules that have to be the same about how you're not meant to conform. So apparently, if you're an experienced goth, you can wear baby pink because it's ironic. But if you're a younger goth and you wear pink, well, you're out, yeah? So working out those norms are really important. Third magnetic point, deliverance. Is there a way out? Now, deliverance here is, this is a common religious category of worldview or whatever you might want to say. We know that there's something not quite right with the world. It's a common and little disputed notion. There is finitude, brokenness, wrongdoing. The problem of suffering consistently confronts us. And so the problem here is we all can't agree on what the problem is, let alone whether there's a solution. Now, in the deliverance magnetic point, I want to nuance it a little bit. It's not simply a looking forward to, if only this happened, the world could be like this. There is that. But there's also a looking back. It's kind of a nostalgia, or you know what Lewis talks about in terms of Sehnsucht. You know, the romantics, after the bloodshed of the French Revolution, the romantics come along. And remember, the romantics used to build ruins. They built ruins because it gave that idea of the Arthurian legends, a time when we could go back. And deliverance is deliverance from, but it can be a deliverance back that we kind of think is important. And deliverance isn't just, again, thinking about waking up in the morning thinking, what is going to happen when I die? I mean, you know, there are those existential thoughts that people have. But it can be deliverance from, how do I get through the day without another drink? How do I get through the day without smacking my kids? How do I get through the day having to work with this particular colleague? Yeah. And then there's even deliverance from thinking about deliverance. So a friend of mine who's a pastor, he's discipling two guys in his congregation who are addicted to the mobile phone game Clash of Clans, just because they want deliverance from having to deal with life. So it's distraction, but it's still religious distraction. It's from having to think about one thing to something else. It's a diversionary tactic in that sense. And again, sidebar here. This is where I don't agree with some of the critique of popular culture not being religious. I mean, Pascal talks about diversion and distraction, yes, but because we're religious, we can't get rid of it. It's going to come out somewhere else in a particular thing that we want to focus our attention on. Of course, there is discussion of deliverance from death. But again, it's really interesting. A pastor friend of mine was walking his dog in the park. He meets someone else who he knew had just had a relative died, and they dabbled in spiritual things. And this friend, who was a well-read urbanite, said to my pastor friend, "Oh, if only someone could come back from the dead to tell us what death is about." Now, if that isn't an apologetic opportunity, but again, that idea of deliverance is important. Okay, fourth, destiny. Now, you shouldn't have favourite children, but this is my favourite magnetic point. Bavinck's brilliant here because he realises this has been a philosophical question for thousands of years and a very mundane question. Bavinck says, he has this great line, human beings at the same time we think that we lead our lives and we undergo our lives. Monday, Wednesday, Friday, I am the master of my own destiny. I can do what I want to do. I can shape reality. Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, I'm a pawn in someone else's chess game. I'm a victim. I'm a puppet on someone else's string. And Bavinck says we can never reconcile those two things. I mean, we have it. I mean, you know, we spend our theological time talking about the relationship between divine sovereignty and responsibility. But this is the same thing, but in a kind of a religious consciousness form. Now, in the book, I talk a lot about superstition, especially the phenomena of one of my students who used to work in an office where you couldn't say it's quiet today, because if you said quiet, you'd make the shift busy. And I thought this was ridiculous. And then you realize it's everywhere, this idea of saying you can't say it's quiet because you'll make the shift busy. A&E departments, classic on that. My son, who's a policeman, he says, right, on the radio, when a shift starts, you can't say it's quiet. You have to use the letter Q, because if you say quiet, it will make it busy, and then everyone will be cross with you. And these are perfectly rational people who have no interest in religion at all. So I talk about superstition, but I think the thing I want to focus on a little bit here are two things, which are symptomatic since I've written the book and been doing this material. The first is this, talking to a group of undergraduate students in the local university that I am at, Newcastle University. They were doing a mission and they wanted to do the mission talks, lunchtime talks based on the magnetic points. So I was trying to get them to think about what are the issues that students are dealing with. So the first thing that was the talk of the student world was this phenomena called manifesting. Have you heard of manifesting? So it sometimes uses crystals. It's literally, Oprah popularized it. I think there was this book, what was the book called? The Secret, thank you, that has sold millions of copies. Thank you, I knew you'd know that, Christy. That sold millions of copies. Oprah kind of popularized it. It's this idea that if you think something with good vibes enough, it will happen. And there's all kinds of different ways you can do it, through crystals or getting to the sound vibration of the earth that then gives you these things. So, at this university, the non-Christian friend of the Christian student I knew, she believed that week she'd manifested her boyfriend. She wanted a boyfriend. She did these techniques and the boyfriend appeared. Okay? So radical kind of, and it's everywhere. I mean, it's massive. Okay? Some of you might be thinking, oh, what on earth is this? This is niche. This is not niche. This is everywhere. Okay? That's the first thing that the students were talking about. The second thing they were dealing with, and this is tragic, well, I think manifesting is tragic, but there was a boycott of nightclubs for Freshers Week. So people weren't going into Newcastle to the nightclubs because some students had become very ill through injection spiking, date rape drugs in the neck. And there was a mass that people were talking about that. Now, do you see how those two interesting things talk about destiny at the same time? On the one hand, I can literally bring reality into existence. On the other, I'm scared and fearful that I'm going to be controlled. Now, I didn't make the point, couldn't you manifest not to be injection spiked? But you see, those two things are kind of juxtaposed. And the third thing that I've heard from lots of students at the moment is that, not that this explains totally the huge levels in mental illness and depression, but this idea that two students have said to me, we've been told We are the ones who are going to change the world. You can do whatever you want to do. Our parents have mucked things up. You're the ones who are going to sort it out, all the problems. And they get to university, and within the first 2 weeks, they realize they ain't going to change anything. Yeah, they're going to struggle to get a job. They're never going to get a house. They've got no prospects. They're just stuck in this system. And I think the disillusionment that comes with that is unbearable. So destiny is that I think is a very nuanced magnetic point about leading our lives and undergoing our lives. Just the final thing to say on destiny, the cultural spirit of a country deals with this magnetic point differently. I'd love to hear your reflections here. So I did this material in Slovakia. Are there any Slovakians here? No, okay. Slovakia. So I said, if you had the choice between, do you think you're a culture or a country that feels that you're in control or under someone else's control? We did like a doodle poll. 99% of Slovakians, we are a country that are at the bottom. We're the runt. We've always been occupied. It was the Hungarians, then it was the Czechs. You know, we are, and because of that, there's a kind of a passivity. There's a, why do we bother do anything? And these are important religious apologetic points that we need to recognize in terms of understanding a culture. You do the same material in the States. No one has a problem of thinking that they are under control. We're under no one's control. Final magnetic point, which I call the super magnetic point, because it's really how the others converge. And it's not simply, is there a God? That's too unsubtle. It's more, is there transcendence? Is there a reality beyond reality? So you could call it transcendence. Now, this is where I think there's a big difference between Bavinck and our context. When Bavinck's in Indonesia, everyone believes in a higher power. Everyone believes in a God. The question is this God, is this transcendent reality going to give me connection, norm, deliverance, destiny? In our context, I think this is the magnetic point that's buried that we need to excavate. And the way we excavate it is by pushing in on all the other magnetic points to talk about, well, if we're belonging, who do we belong to? Is there a norm? Where does that norm come from? Is there deliverance? But who or what might deliver us? Is there destiny? What's my relationship as a human being to some other force, I suppose? So that's where I think there's a big difference. It's almost an inverted pyramid, as it were, that the more we dig in. And in the West, again, or I suppose I can't talk for all of your countries, but let's talk about the UK, for example. Here you have to factor in 2,000 years of like Christian influence, which has created what could be called an afterglow of Christianity that we see in what might be called secularized religious experiences. So a friend of mine, dad was an atheist. They went to the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem and felt something. It's a lot of what was going on when Queen Elizabeth died. You know, I feel we need to go down to London. I'm not religious at all, but there's something here. It's the classic kind of, the Julian Barnes, the author, the atheist author who wrote a book on death called Nothing to Be Scared Of. He starts the book, I don't believe in God, but I miss him. It's that kind of hauntedness that Taylor talks about a lot. And I think that transcendence thing, and again, it's theologically, it's just saying, however much we try to suppress the truth, it always has to squeeze out somewhere, and it will show itself somewhere. I mean, the book, I come up with this ridiculous thing that goes on in the UK called champing. Churches that are derelict, where you can pay to camp in the church overnight so you can feel something. So there was on one of the television networks, there was this great middle-class couple who wanted to sleep in a church because she wanted her kids to wake up in the morning with the experience of light coming through the stained glass window, to have some kind of experience. And I think there's lots of that kind of thing. Now that might lead to the question, is there a God? But the higher power is more the kind of the way beyond transcendence. Okay, right. So these are the magnetic points. And now the question becomes, as our friend said over here, how does that connect to the gospel? And this is part of a bigger project, I suppose, or science, as it were, a word that I'm trying to popularized, and I would love our seminaries to have departments of it. J.H. Bavinck was a big champion. It's called alenctics. So alenctics comes from the Greek word alengos, to unmask, to convict. Jesus talks about this is the Holy Spirit's job in John 16. This is the word groups that's used in Titus about the pastor who needs to teach in sound doctrine and refute error, alengos. So in the 19th century, what you could call missionary apologetics, these were departments of alenctics. And J.H. Bavinck's book, An Introduction to the Science of Missions, he calls it a science. So I think it's great. Interestingly, John Stott in Mission to the Modern World, which is in the 70s, he thought that alenctics was very important in what would become interfaith dialogue. So I'm on the alenctics campaign. Unfortunately, it's quite a hard word to make people think this is really interesting. Yeah, thank you. Well, it's better that way. It's either that or we have departments of idolatry. I mean, you could have either one. Anyway, okay. So this is where the subversive fulfillment idea comes in that I've spoken a lot about in previous work. So I'm just going to very quickly give you a summary of that because then it fits to the magnetic points. So subversive fulfillment is the understanding of how the gospel, how Jesus Christ relates to culture. It's not my term. It was popularized. I've popularized it, but it was mentioned by a very famous Dutch Reformed missiologist called Hendrik Cramer, who was at these big missionary conferences in Edinburgh in 1910, Tambaran in India. And at the time when they were discussing, people were starting to talk about how Hinduism and Buddhism, Jesus was the fulfillment of those religions. So Jesus was a stepping stone. And Cramer, who's a polymath, an amazing guy who kind of bestrides these councils, he was really unhappy with this idea. He says, Jesus is not the fulfillment. You cannot talk about Jesus is completely other. Now, there's lots of things going with Cramer there. He's a little more Barthian than I would be, but let's go with it at the moment. But in one article, he says, look, if we're going to talk about fulfillment, let's talk about Jesus as the contradictive or subversive fulfillment of other religions. And exegetically, the key passage for me here is 1 Corinthians 1. Again, we don't have time, just very quickly. Remember, 1 Corinthians 1, on the one hand, the cross is foolishness. It is a big fat no to the world's ways of doing things. It's the opposite. We preach Christ crucified. It is foolishness to the world's ways of working. So the cross, Jesus Christ crucified, always confronts. But, and, it also connects. Why in that passage does Paul talk about two different ethnic groups, Jews and Greeks? He could have just said, we preach Christ crucified. I don't care where you come from, who you are, what your ethnicity is, what your background is. We preach Christ crucified. But no, he takes the time to distinguish between two groups, Jews and Greeks, who both have different social imaginaries, as Charles Taylor would call it, or worldviews, or hopes, desires, and dreams. For Jews, that is around signs, power. For Greeks, it's wisdom. Jews are not Greeks. Greeks are not Jews. Jews are not particularly looking for wisdom, and Greeks aren't looking for power. So why does Paul mention those two Greeks? Because those two groups? Because at the end of that passage, he says to those who have been saved, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. Now we say, oh, Paul, that's a felt needs gospel. You mean Jews are looking for power and Jesus is power? Yes. Greeks are looking for wisdom and Jesus is wisdom? Yes. In precisely the opposite or subversive way that Jews and Greeks think that power and wisdom are delivered. A crucified Messiah is not powerful. A crucified Messiah is not wise, and yet Paul still makes the connection. And, as I say a lot of times, generally speaking, some evangelical apologists are great at the confrontation, not so good at the connection. Some are great at the connection, but not so good at the confrontation. And the gospel interacts with culture in a subversive fulfillment way. It both subverts and it fulfills at the same time. So what we have to do as we come back to the magnetic points, and again, in my previous book, Plugged In, I talk about a little program, how we do this based on Act 17, Enter, Explore, Expose, Evangelize. We need to show how the magnetic points are both subverted and fulfilled in Jesus Christ. Badink says, the gospel of Christ addresses people and rips open their religious consciousness. People want to suppress and push away the gospel in the worst way, just as they have repeatedly done with God. But it can happen that God causes their heart to submit. Then all the engines of resistance are switched off and people listen. Then the King of Glory makes his entrance. The everlasting doors of the understanding are thrown open. And this is what we call the new birth. So what we have to do, again, this isn't a different gospel. It's the same gospel, the same truths that we want to proclaim, the call to faith and repentance. But the magnetic points give us a kind of a texture, having resonated, found the magnetic points that people are trying to answer, to say, how does Jesus in his person and work subversively fulfill the magnetic points? So, for example, I mean, you know, Jesus Christ is the way that we connect. So what we have to do apologetically is two things. The ways in which people want to connect and find their significance through belonging, there is a part of our apologetic that has to do expose, you know. So I think Andrew might have mentioned about the sport being a point of connection. Now, how do we expose that? Well, it is trying to say things like, when England lose a football match, rates of domestic violence go up. We had a student who did a great spoken word piece on this material, where he narrated his childhood growing up, where depending on how the match went, meant whether was he going to go home that night, was his mum going to send him somewhere else. When the team was winning, it was brilliant. When the team was losing, it was terrible. Yeah, that is part of the kind of exposure of the idolatry, and then to show how we find connection and belonging in Christ. Again, this is where Christian doctrine, this is where theology is so important for apologetics. Badink says, look, we're wrestling between the idea, are we insignificant or significant? The doctrine of the image of God cuts through that straight away. We're insignificant. We're only images. But we're hugely significant. We're images of God. Now, you think that is such a revolutionary, radically, subversively fulfilling doctrine that we have something to say. It's a uniquely distinct doctrine. Muslims don't believe that Muslims are in the image of Allah. We are in the image of God. We can talk about union with Christ. We can talk about how the church is meant to be the most totalizing, inclusive community, where we find true connection with each other because we have communion with God. So all we're doing here is just using Christian doctrine to try and answer those magnetic points. The norm, you know, Jesus says, you know, I'm the fulfillment of the law. Jesus should appeal to both moral conservatives and progressives at the same time. Jesus is against hypocrisy. He's for the marginalized. And yet the law of God does not change. Jesus gives us deliverance. Our enmity with God is the source of all of our other mini problems, and that's what we need to look at. Jesus is the way of control. You know, when I used to get a taxi in London, invariably it would be a Muslim driver with an evil eye, the evil eye kind of warding off the spirits. I can say to that taxi driver, I don't deny those spirits exist, but I believe in one who is Lord over all spirits. And I can call him a loving heavenly father. This isn't a blind fate or force, but a loving heavenly father. And Jesus Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. He is the one who connects us. He is the one who gives us the norm. He is the one who gives us our identity from the outside. So again, this is all very kind of, but what I would want people to try and do in their own context is to say, okay, what does this mean for my evangelistic conversations I have with people? To go around, wander around, look at the objects of worship and start to make those connections, because there's always traction. It's saying every human being is a theologian and not a great theologian, but we have truth to bring. Now, two final points before questions. This is important apologetically. The first is, this isn't the Good Book Company who published it. This is not their fault, but the book has been marketed as kind of evangelism and apologetics, which it is. But first of all, it is about discipleship. Our evangelism flows from our discipleship. And there's a great quote I have in the book by Spurgeon, who preached this sermon, taking my idea of the marvelous magnet. I don't know how he did it. It's called The Marvelous Magnet, where he says that, you know, as we are united and connected to Christ, other people will be connected to us who will be connected to Christ. If we lose our connection with Christ, basically we will be demagnetized and that won't attract anyone. So at the end of the book, a pastor friend of mine said, and he meant this as a compliment, he said it was a complete anticlimax. I thought, oh, okay. But he said, because at the end of the book, the way that we stay magnetized is, one, applying these magnetic points to ourselves in our own discipleship. How am I drawn away by other things? Beloved, keep yourselves from idols. Yeah. And also, I do think at the end of the day, the way that we are re-magnetized is through the ordinary means of grace. You know, we go out into the week, into our vocations. We're hungry, we're tired, we're disorientated. We come to the people of God. We are fed, we're bandaged, we're re-magnetized and sent out. And that happens every single week. And there's something just about how the church is apologetic at that point is important. So that's the first point. So the discipleship angle is really important. I want to get that across in this kind of teaching. If you don't do that, you just see people as objects and you say, I'm going to do the magnetic point. No, this is where J.H. Baring's brilliant, because he has this, he talks about the meeting of love and the wounds which I inflict on the other by the gospel of grace have been inflicted on me first. And we always need to remember that in our apologetics. And secondly, is something I'm trying to develop, which I'm going to call pre-evangelism. Just before he died a few weeks ago, Tim Keller wrote an article called Lemonade on the Porch, where he argues that in America, there used to be a time where people could walk down the road and there were porches where people could serve lemonade. It was a kind of a social space. And he says that in America, the American culture has been the porch to introduce people to Christianity. But now the culture is not the porch, and that we need to make porches where we can serve lemonade and offer people in. Now, I think that's pre-evangelism, and I think the magnetic points here is really important. So, and there's one great example, and this is a brilliant apologetic resource. So a company in a charity in the UK, Christian charity called 219, I do some work with them. They teach English language because it's a good thing to do. English is a second language. And they also want to talk about Christ. So it's kind of, they're teaching in the English language and they want to talk about Jesus. And what they've done here is, it's brilliant. They've taken 60 world proverbs. So they look at different proverbs from different cultures. Gain something, lose something from Thailand. Practice makes perfect, apparently, is Germany. Uben macht den Mais. So people are coming, they're learning language, they're discussing these proverbs. Proverbs, of course, are worldview, little bits of worldview. They discuss the proverb, and then they're what are called bridge proverbs that link to each one of the magnetic points. And then that gives an opportunity to talk about Christ in terms of how Jesus, who is utter wisdom, to be able to do it. So that's a great example. But I could imagine apologetically you could create what I'm going to call magnetic spaces. You could do parenting courses, which is good. It's good. You know, this whole thing at the moment is we've got to understanding that we are different is a great thing to understand and to have civility with one another. We've lost the ability to talk to each other. Conversational difference leads, I think, to conversational difference. Conversational difference, that's the pre-evangelism. So someone could do this course, or they could do a parenting course, and they could say, do you know what, I've been equipped to become a better parent. But actually, the guy who was a Christian there said something that actually I'm interested in exploring that further. So there's kind of civility that's promoted, which we all need, which is good for the gospel, and there's an evangelistic opportunity. And I wonder whether the magnetic points give a... You could do it on leadership, you could do it on all kinds of things.